Our next case is Party Homes of Nevada versus James Wolfram et al., case number 72371. Ms. Lundwall, are you ready to proceed?
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. My name is Pat Lundwall. I'm here on behalf of the appellate, Party Homes of Nevada. I intend to try to reserve 3 to 5 minutes then for rebuttal. In this two-party breach of contract case, the district court awarded over $135,000 in attorney's fees as special damages. In doing so, she cited broad language from the Sandy Valley decision that required proximate causation and reasonable foreseeability as the only foundation for imposition of those attorney's fees. Under her findings of fact and conclusions of law, she rationalized that if Party breached a contract, that it was reasonably foreseeable that Mr. Wolfram and Mr. Wilkes may incur attorney's fees in prosecuting that two-party action.
Ms. Lundwall, as one reads Sandy Valley, Oregon, and Lou, it caused me to wonder whether all of this is predicated on dicta. Generally speaking, holdings in a case like Sandy Valley are necessary to the disposition of the case. What I find odd about the Sandy Valley panel per curiam opinion is the fact that none of the commentary that is now being quoted as holdings for Sandy Valley was essential to the decision in the case, because at the end of the day, the court or the panel in that case said there was no special pleading of damages, and as a consequence, on that basis, they disregarded the award of fees. Should this court revisit Sandy Valley, or at least treat these declarations as commentary and dicta?
What I think that the court should do for purposes of this case to ensure adherence to the American rule and not the destruction of the American rule in two-party cases is to adopt the bright line, or actually to reaffirm a bright line test that states when parties, like at issue in this case, had the foresight to include an attorney fee provision within their contract, that there is no need, there's no reason to look beyond that and to find special damages in those cases. Roland versus Lapeer was quite clear. Special damages, attorney's fees as special damages, are not to be imposed in two-party breach of contract actions. If you look at the footnote 2 from Lou, that was one of the progeny then from Sandy Valley, it made express the fact that Ms. Lou, in prosecuting her two-party breach of contract action, was not entitled to special damages, attorney's fees as special damages in that case. And so for purposes of this case, all the court needs to do is to reaffirm a bright line test that when the parties have the foresight to include an attorney fee provision that identifies the circumstances under which that they may recover attorney's fees and costs, that there is no need then to go beyond that and look to special damages. We brought the footnote in lieu. We brought those practical aspects to the district court, and the district court then ignored our advocacy on that point. And in fact, if you, this error by the district court goes unchecked, really what it does is it heralds the destruction of the American rule in two-party cases. And what it would do is it would rewrite the party's contract in this case. So let me turn to the second award of attorney's fees then that was issued by the district court. It was over $500,000, almost $500,000 in attorney's fees and costs. So let me put that award in context. What Pardee did wrong, according to the district court, in this case, was not to give certain contracts to Mr. Wolfram and Mr. Wilkes that were protected by a confidentiality clause. Now, the court expressly found that that confidentiality clause prohibited CSI, who is the other party to these contracts, from giving those contracts to Mr. Wolfram and Wilkes, but she held us to a different standard. And so we, those contracts were what we did wrong. Withholding those contracts is what we did wrong. So what did the district court then find as a result of reviewing those contracts? That Pardee had told the truth to Mr. Wolfram and Wilkes all along. It confirmed the truth that it had not purchased any option property, that it had not monkeyed around with any definitions of option property or purchase property, that it had paid to Mr. Wolfram and Mr. Wilkes every commission that was due and owing to them, which was in excess of $2.6 million. Those contracts confirmed that Pardee had told the truth to Mr. Wolfram and Wilkes, and it confirmed that that truth was known upon review of those contracts.
But Ms. Lumbo, the Second Amendment complaint is grounded in accounting and a breach of contract for failure to provide information they believe they were entitled to. It would seem, according to the court's order, they prevailed on those claims. So why doesn't that, in and of itself, I know we're talking about commissions, but the gravamen of the Second Amendment complaint is not about commissions. And so to the extent the court found they prevailed, why aren't they entitled to attorney's fees under the contract provision that you're talking about?
To embrace that, Your Honor, what you have to do is you have to accept form over substance. You have to accept that the two theories that were advanced by Mr. Wolfram and Wilkes at the time of trial resulted in a win for Pardee and a win for them. And so it's a mixed result case. And so if you look at the naked judgment in this case, the court then says, yes, that they prevailed on a breach of contract and a breach of covenant of good faith and fair dealing claim. It also then ordered an accounting then as a result of those findings. But when you look at the two theories that in fact had been advanced by Mr. Wolfram and Wilkes, we had prevailed on the theory that drove this case. And I think it is particularly important in a way to underscore that is because every nickel of the almost $500,000 in attorney's fees that were incurred under the prevailing party provision was incurred after they received the contracts that they claimed they were seeking as part of this litigation. In other words, once they received the contracts, what did they do? Did they review those contracts and to confirm that Pardee had told them the truth, as was found by the district court? Did they invoke Rule 41 and seek a voluntary dismissal of their claim? No. What they did is they took those contracts and they advanced a losing theory. They spent almost $500,000 advancing that losing theory, and they forced Pardee to match them nearly dollar for dollar. And so what the district court did in her award under the prevailing party provision is she rewarded Mr. Wolfram and Wilkes for advancing a losing theory. And she punished Pardee for succeeding on that losing theory. She exalted form over substance. So if you look into the analytical process then associated with what the district court did, she abused her discretion both in finding, making a clearly erroneous finding, as well as using the wrong legal analysis. So let's start with the legal analysis. Nearly every commercial contract, no different than the one here, had allowed for a prevailing party, and it did not limit prevailing party to either a plaintiff or a defendant. In other words, it was a two-way street. And so what the district court did, though, is it looked to the statutory cases that had been urged upon her by the plaintiffs, and it looked to those statutory cases that examined a prevailing party under statutory theory. Now, under statutory theory, those cases are those provisions are classically a one-way street. In other words, a plaintiff is entitled to recovery of attorney's fees if they are prevailing. And so what the cases in the statutory theory cases look to is whether or not a plaintiff prevails on any portion or receives any benefit from their claims. It does not look at the pragmatic component, and the cases even go so far as to say that a defendant is not entitled to attorney's fees prevailing on those statutory claims.
Well, how else, besides asking a court for an accounting, will they ever be able to tell whether or not any future contracts are breached? I mean, that I get it. At the end of the day here, it wasn't breached. But how do we know in the future that won't happen? They're just going to rely on parties saying, oh, no, it's good, it's confidential?
No, Your Honor. There was a whole series of public documents that were required to be filed by party and CSI in the event that we purchased option property. There was an option property memorandum. That memorandum required edits or reductions in the size of the option property. There was a notice of option property. There was an exercise of option property. There were tentative maps. There were like six different public documents that would be filed if party had purchased option property.
Let me ask you this. There's only two claims for relief in the second amended, the accounting and the breach of contract. Oh, wait, no, and the covenant and good faith of fair dealing. It does appear that the court, the district court, found for them on accounting and also for the breach of contract on the covenant of good faith and fair dealing. How does the district court abuse its discretion and the attorney's fees as the prevailing party then?
Well, how the court abused her discretion is in twofold, both her factual findings as well as in her legal findings. She embraced the statutory causes of action, the statutory cases defining what a prevailing party was, and she ignored the contract cases. That's point one, given my time. Point two, though, on her analysis, is that in her analysis, her factual analysis and her reasoning for the imposition of attorney's fees, she identified specifically, and I can articulate where within the record for the court's review, that the reason or the purpose behind trying to discover this information was to confirm that they were entitled to more commissions. In her findings, under the prevailing party, she expressly says this case was about information so they could determine the additional commissions that they were entitled to. She says, but they lost on that, but this case was about information. So she identified the very purpose for which that this case moved on and over $1 million in attorney's fees were incurred, and that was the theory that they were advancing as to if we review these additional contracts that we got, we will learn that we're entitled to all these additional commissions that were identified in the Rule 16.1 disclosure, that were cited at the time of trial, and that were argued at the time of trial. So those are the two ways that the court had abused her discretion. And what I would urge upon the court is this. If you look at Bergman versus Boyce, if you look at University of Nevada versus Tarkanian, this court has taken a very pragmatic approach in mixed result cases to apportion damages, or to apportion attorney's fees between successful and unsuccessful claims. The court has adopted that same approach when it comes to costs that are incurred. If in FTB versus Hyatt,
so when you argued the case in front of the district court, or when that issue about fees and costs on prevailing party was addressed, did you concede that some fees and costs would be appropriate, at least up to the point where the future accounting and documents were produced?
What we acknowledged to the court and what we had urged upon the district court was language then from the two cases that we also brought to this court's attention, Swee and Berkeley, suggesting that the pragmatic approach needed to be looked at, is that the court needed to analyze then what was the most substantial issue, what was the
driving force. Did you ask the district court to allocate the fees before and after the production of the agreements?
We did not. But in this particular...
Are you asking this? That seems to be fundamental to your argument here today.
What we are suggesting to this court is this, that the district court erred and that error can be corrected. And that error, in correcting that error, should be sent with instructions that instruct the district courts to take a pragmatic approach and apportion then between successful and unsuccessful claims. And there is a very bright line in this particular case for defining that. Whatever fees that were incurred prior to receipt of these contracts, they may have succeeded upon. But all of the fees and the bolt and the engine that drove this train, the $1 million that was incurred by both parties, was on a theory upon which that they lost and that we prevailed. And therefore, that is the bright line of demarcation that we are urging the court to accept and to instruct the district court then to adopt.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Lundahl.
Good morning. James Jimerson on behalf of respondents Wolfram and Wilkes. I'd like to take note of the fact that Mr. Wolfram and Walt Wilkes' son, Tom, are in the gallery today. May it please the court. This case, first and foremost, was for the quest for documents and information. As Justice Stiglitz appropriately observed, the complaint, the operative complaint, the complaint that was first filed in 2010, called for, first and foremost, production of the information and an accounting. It was the first prayer for relief. Was for the production of the documents as well as an order on accounting and then for damages and for any relief the court may deem proper and just. Wolfram and Wilkes succeeded on every single one of their causes of action. On the accounting claim, on the breach of contract claim, and breach of the implied covenant claim. They also succeeded on Pardee's counterclaim for the breach of the implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing. Once again, Pardee has failed to disclose to you that portion of this case. So, Wolfram and Wilkes succeeded on all four causes of action, and yet Pardee stands here telling you they won the case. They're telling you because they were the prevailing party under a contract theory.
Well, actually, I don't hear Ms. Lundahl saying that. What I hear her saying is what the district court's order seems to have said as well. That there was a portion of the complaint that you did not succeed on. And the district court says that, correct?
The district court doesn't say there was a portion of the complaint that was not successful. There was a portion of the theory of liability that was raised actually during trial. And I make that decision importantly because there was a discovery during trial that Pardee had redesignated the property from multifamily to single-family homes, and the single-family homes property was the property that our clients could be entitled to a commission for. And it was upon that theory that we presented a request for unpaid commissions. There wasn't a single theory of unpaid commissions prior to trial. And the reference to the $1.8 million disclosure is all wrong, is fiction, because it was theoretical, hypothetical. According to Pardee's own counsel in her unsworn declaration after trial, that disclosure concerned future commissions, not commissions due and owing. So when you look at what we were asking for, you're correct. There was a portion of liability that we were asking for relief from, and we did not receive. However, that does not convert us from being a prevailing party to a non-prevailing party. And the reason I bring the contract issue up, Your Honor, is that the parties agreed to this prevailing party the prevailing party award of attorney's fees and costs. And when the parties, both represented by counsel, both negotiating this agreement, reached that agreement, they adopted Nevada law. And Nevada law in contract cases, as well as statutory cases, uses the same definition. And that is a prevailing party is one that succeeds on a significant issue and receives some of the relief that it was seeking. We know that from the Hornwood versus Smith's Food King decision, in which the plaintiffs there only succeeded.
By the way, I was the law clerk in that case. with Judge White.
You would know then that the plaintiff succeeded on only one of their theories of liability and yet were determined by this court to be the prevailing party. You would know from the Davis versus Bellin decision that party cites in its briefs. It cites to Valley Electric versus Overfields for the determination of what a prevailing party is. And in Valley Electric, that applied the prevailing party standard from NRS 18.010.
What do you say about her argument, though, regarding the special damages? She wants us to adopt like a bright line type of test compared to what is out there as far as the three cases that we're looking at. Do you think that the illustrations of special damage awards are exhaustive or non-exhaustive?
I don't believe they are exhaustive, and that was in our briefing. We actually believe that the natural and proximate language forms the basis for it, and it's tough because the American rule does stand, and the court in Sandy Valley was providing three types of examples of cases that would be an exception to that.
So I'd like to ask you, Mr. Jimerson, the same thing I asked Ms. Lundvall. Reading the Sandy Valley opinion then and now, as well as Horgan and Liu, it seems to me that there's an awful lot of dicta in Sandy Valley.
There is.
It trails off. It almost reads like a law review as opposed to a decision.
Some of the footnotes would support that.
And I just raise the question about whether, and in fairness to the bar and in fairness to litigants, they've seen this case. It's been out there. It has this language, but then the court and counsel in Horgan and Liu struggled to try to figure out what this rambling sort of dicta meant. I'm wondering if we shouldn't just revisit the whole concept. It seems to be anathema and completely outside what we generally view as a basis for fees, which is contract, rule, or statute.
Correct, and I think that there's a good basis to maintain at least some of the examples within Sandy Valley. And the reason for it would be that when there is, for example, take slander of title, when there is an affirmative, bad faith, malicious act that causes someone to come to court and say, "Judge, rescue me from this malicious act. I have no way of getting the relief otherwise."
But the thing of it is, and in fairness to you and to your argument, we should probably address that when we have a slander of title case.
Correct, but I think that
not go through some laundry list in a case that isn't even raising that subject and start venturing out about what is or is not included and then have the bar guess about what the court meant or didn't mean in that context.
Well, I think that I was using the slander title as an example because I think it's one of the examples of the third exceptions articulated in Sandy Valley, and that is in actions for injunctive or declaratory relief necessitated by a defendant's bad faith conduct, attorney's fees as damages may be available. And slander title, I would argue, would be an example of that, is a bad faith act that necessitates injunctive or declaratory relief.
So to my earlier point, the case says, in a matter that didn't involve injunctive relief, that these fees might be recoverable in some future case, equity case, I guess is the way you would construe it, because in your case you're talking about the equitable effort to secure accounting and records. But nonetheless, there's nothing in that statement that is essential or a part of the holding, really, of the Sandy Valley decision. Would you agree with that?
Correct, but I think that it traces its origins from a long history, at least for that portion, of the affirmative bad faith actions that require injunctive or other equitable relief. It has a long history of cases. The City of Las Vegas versus Craven Industries cases that we cited. Roland versus Lapeer, that party cited just now in their notice of supplementary authorities. In making the statement they relied upon, they cited to Von Aronsman versus Lee. And Von Aronsman versus Lee, this court stated, where equitable relief is sought, an award of attorney's fees is proper if awarded as an item of damages. And the reason for that is just, is because if there is no other way to get the relief that a plaintiff or another party is seeking except to get to court and get an order, attorney's fees have to be a natural and proximate consequence of that conduct. So the idea of arguing that whenever there is a breach of contract case, that there cannot be a side-by-side basis for attorney's fees as damages is not grounded in the law. Summa versus Greenspan, the court articulated, that was a contract case, but the court affirmed an award of attorney's fees as damages, not because there was a breach of contract, mind you, but because of the equitable relief being requested. So in terms of revisiting Sandy Valley, I think that there would be room and a basis to articulate exactly what you're saying, that Sandy Valley may have addressed issues that were not before the court at that point. However, the basis for that dicta is still grounded in
The standalone argument for special damages in your case would be that they rest on the equitable claims.
Correct, Your Honor. And here's the issue, and I think this is important. At least it also relates back to the prevailing party issue.
If I might interrupt you,
I'm sorry.
I apologize. So then, is the $135,000 the fees that were incurred up to the point in time where the accounting order had been resolved and the documents produced?
No, Your Honor. The accounting order had been resolved well after trial. If that is articulated and admitted in evidence, our bills were only through the discovery period, and we only asked for a subsection of the attorney's fees. We were very conservative in requesting attorney's fees as damages. We understood the prevailing party was going to carry the day, but we also didn't want to forfeit our right to attorney's fees as damages because we were asking for equitable relief as a result of parties' bad faith conduct. And by the way, there is no dispute that party engaged in bad faith conduct. The district court found the same, and party has not challenged it in the briefing. There was a suggestion that because they were confidential, that party had a right to withhold them. The district court said, no, that is a pretext because they had already been produced. Other confidential documents have been produced to our clients. And it wasn't as if party simply sat on its hands and refused to provide the documents. They got on the phone and affirmatively interfered with our client's attempt to get the documents from other sources, telling Stuart Title, tell them they have everything. Don't give them anything. Knowing that that was false. So the basis for withholding the documents wasn't simply a we don't want to give the documents. There was additional conduct, there was additional bad faith actions that the district court found above and beyond the contractual duties and above and beyond the common law duty that the court found that there existed a special relationship of trust between the parties. So this would be another factor in terms of attorney's fees and damages. If there is an independent basis to provide the information, the other material, aside from a contract, because the court found there was, and that's not been challenged here, there has to be a preservation of the availability of attorney's fees and damages concerning such equitable requests for equitable relief. And when Parkey gets up here and tells you they should have just filed a NRCP 41 notice of dismissal once they got the documents under subpoena, why? So that they don't get the order on accounting that compels them to do something in the event that there are their future activity? The court specifically required them to produce any further amendments to the amended and restated option agreement that were being withheld. The courts required immediately upon the order to provide a declaration concerning the assignment of the obligations. By the way, notice of the assignment was not provided, and we did not learn that from Part D. We learned it from the newspaper. We received notice from public sources. They picked up the phone afterwards. That is what party has done over and over and over again, which is why this case truly is the exceptional case.
Mr. Jimerson, in addition to the special damages, the 135 $1,000 in attorney's fees. The court also found consequential damages, correct?
Yes.
Yeah, amount of $6,000?
Correct, Your Honor.
So in the event that the special damages, if you even took those out, do you think under the contract, your client's still a prevailing party?
Yes, Your Honor, and the reason I would say that is as follows. The definition of prevailing party is both parties understood and agreed under Nevada law is one that you only need to win a significant issue, you only need to receive some of the relief you're requesting to be a prevailing party. That was the contract and that was agreed upon. So the idea of pragmatism, the pragmatism is to let the parties enforce what the parties agreed upon. But we articulated this in our briefs, and I would reply, I would refer the court to page 57, note 32 of our brief, in which we articulated that we would still be entitled to the prevailing party attorney's fees if the court were to reverse on the attorney's fees and special damages, especially if the court were to adopt a rule that a prevailing party provision wouldn't moot any need for attorney's fees as special damages. So we would incorporate, we would receive, should receive, the $135,000 as the prevailing party because that amount was subtracted from the prevailing party attorney's fees because we received them as special damages.
So let me ask one additional question and that's
yes,
score. obviously, the judge said that there was a theory that you didn't prevail on. Did the judge allocate the collective amount of fees requested to the work devoted to the theory on which you lost?
No.
Even under the prevailing party rule, it seems to me that judges in this state need to allocate fees to the causes of action or theories on which one prevails and not, if possible, anyway.
Well, I would return to your last portion right, in terms of apportionment or allocation.
Mm-hmm.
That certainly was not agreed upon between the parties because the allocation, there's no Nevada law that requires such allocation. In fact, the prevailing party definition does not call for the allocation.
Did party in the district court ask for allocation?
No, they did not. And the reason they did not, I would suspect, and because the court expressly found and stated later at the conclusion of trial, was that the secondary theory of liability, because it was raised at trial, during trial, so there was no discovery on it aside from asking Mr. Whittemore or Mr. Lash about what was going on, that was what was here. So in terms of if the court wanted to ask the court to allocate, it would be very difficult to do so because we are quite literally in the throes of combat during trial. And therefore, the court appropriately awarded the attorney's fees that were incurred by Wolfram & Wilkes in this case to get the all-important order of accounting that party didn't tell you about in its opening brief.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Dunball, I'll give you a minute and a half as counsel ran over on his time.
There's two points that I want to make during this brief time. The first deals with the timeline concerning the imposition of attorney's fees that was done by the district court. The district court awarded as special damages every nickel that had been imposed since the beginning of the case all the way up until the close of discovery. That was $135,000. That's what they presented at the time of trial were the special damages that they claimed. And then what the court did is she picked up from where she ended off in her award of special damages and said the prevailing party fees then are everything that was incurred thereafter. And it was actually the time frame was March of 2013. And so the in excess of almost $500,000 was incurred after then that discovery had closed and after we were at trial. So that's point number one from a timeline perspective. They received the contracts during discovery in August of 2012. The only things that the district court found that we should have given but had not were discovered in August of 2012. And so if you would look at in a portion in the time and the attorney's fees that they spent getting those contracts from the beginning of the case until August of 2012, it pales in comparison to all of the fees that were incurred thereafter chasing a theory of recovery of additional commissions. Now, the second point...
I think that can wrap. I'll give you just a few minutes just to a few seconds. Just finish your thought, please.
Thank you, Your Honor. What I would urge the court to do is to look at the opposition to the motion for summary judgment that was filed by Wolfram and Wilkes. It articulates their theory of additional commissions, and it stands in stark contrast to what they told you here today.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Lundvall. Thank you, Mr. Jimerson, for your excellent arguments and briefing. The case will stand submitted in the court.